Welcome to More Than Wealth with Darren Gold and Samantha Hotchkins from the Gold Wealth Management Group. In this podcast, we help business executives, business owners, and high net worth individuals navigate the multifaceted world of wealth planning. No matter how complex the situation, we provide financial advice and guidance to instill greater confidence in pursuing your life's goals. By leveraging the vast resources of UBS and collaborating with a team of external specialists, we'll delve into both basic and complex planning topics. Beyond the numbers, we'll also explore the stories behind the wealth. By interviewing business owners and thought leaders in our community, we aim to share insightful and inspiring tales of success. Join us on this journey where we explore wealth and the compelling stories behind it on More Than Wealth.
Hello and welcome to the More Than Wealth podcast with the team from Gold Wealth Management Group. Today's guest is Thomas T. Pearls, MD, MPH, FACP. Dr. Pearls is a geriatrician and the director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center, BMC. Dr. Pearls is also a professor of medicine and geriatrics at Boston University Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine. An international leader in the field of human exceptional longevity, Dr. Pearls is the founder and director of the New England Centenarian Study, the largest study of centenarians and their families in the world. He's also a principal investigator of the NIA-funded Long Life Family Study. Dr. Pearls is also a vocal critic of the anti-aging industry and has been responsible for numerous novel and pivotal findings in the field. He is also an expert in epidemiology, genetics of aging, and exceptional longevity. Now, here are the hosts of the More Than Wealth podcast, Darren Gold and Samantha Hotchkins.
What if living longer wasn't about luck or chasing the next miracle pill, but upgrading our day-to-day decisions? Today on More Than Wealth, we're joined by Dr. Thomas Pearls, a geriatrician, a professor, and founder of the New England Centenarian Study, or NECS, at Boston University. NECS is the longest-running study of centenarians and their family members in the world, and he's also authored a book about his research titled Living to 100. Dr. Pearls, welcome to More Than Wealth.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you on. So in our research for this episode, Sam and I quickly realized that we could easily fill an entire season with this topic. So in the interest of time, we'd like to break the discussion into bite-sized sections. So we'll cover genetics, lifestyle, mindset, myths, and the future of longevity.
And to kick it off, Dr. Pearls, we would love to start with just your why. What drew you to studying people over 100? Was it something in your career that kind of pivoted this way, or maybe a personal story you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
Yeah, not at all. I think what happened to me is what any young geriatrics fellow looking for a research project would hope for, which is something that popped up in my day-to-day clinical training and practice. And while I was in my first year of geriatrics fellowship at Harvard, I was also put in charge of taking care of patients on a Florida independent living retirement community. And two of these independent folks happened to be over the age of 100. And immediately what popped into my head was what I had gathered from my training and what everybody had told me, which was that the older you get, the sicker you get. And certainly by the time you're 100, you must have every age-related disease under the sun, have dementia, and be on death's doorstep. And here I had two people living in the independent living part of this community. And when I tried to make appointments with them, you know, I was their doctor, it was impossible. It turned out that this woman who was 101 had a very busy piano concert schedule, playing piano out in the community, playing for schools and stuff. I think people were intrigued and amazed at her at her age, but she was also an incredibly accomplished pianist. The way I got to see her was go to one of her concerts. And I was blown away. And certainly she did not have dementia. She was terrific. I thought, well, that's kind of a one-off and very unusual. Didn't make much of it. Then the other person, a 102-year-old man, he was down in occupational therapy all the time, not receiving therapy, but teaching people about sewing and tailoring. He had been a tailor all his life. And when he wasn't doing that, he was robbing the cradle, dating his 85-year-old girlfriend.
What a youngster.
Two was enough to make a light bulb go off.
Yeah.
Maybe what I had heard was not true. And then I started to find a lot more centenarians to see if what I was seeing was, you know, true for all centenarians or not.
Sure. So let's talk about the logistics of that study. So 30 years, how many people and what metrics were studied? Can you just dive a little bit deeper into the actual study of it?
Our first funding came from the Alzheimer's Association because they also were very intrigued with how do people get to 100 and either markedly delay, like into their late 90s, early 100s, or escape Alzheimer's disease? And could this be a model, a natural occurring human model of resistance or resilience against something like Alzheimer's? And we've collected a lot of data that actually support that idea. And we're about 2,500 subjects into the study. Many of them are centenarians, but we also study their kids, mm-hmm. who very much follow the footsteps of their parents. And we've gone from very careful, detailed neuropsychological testing of these individuals, following them over time and seeing how they do, to collecting blood samples now, doing what I call omicking the heck out of them, where we get a vast amount of molecular biology data from a small blood sample. We're also looking at genetics. We're even now getting into establishing stem cell lines from these individuals, that where we can do all kinds of studies in the lab to discover and then confirm findings.
That's great.
And so let's talk about the science of living long. So you've got this 30-year study, 2,500 people in the study, all 100 years or older. What did you see? What have you seen in terms of specific genes or pathways that show up again and again in centenarians?
So just to correct you for a moment, that the 2,000-some subjects are not all centenarians. I would say over about half are their kids. And we're probably one of the main studies that showed that this can really run strongly in families. And so then when we study their kids, we find that, like their parents, they're aging very slowly and they're markedly delaying or escaping aging-related diseases. And because they are in families, we start to be able to look at what we call concordance and discordance, where we can look at kids where maybe one kid is not doing so well and why would that be. We can look at the chances of brothers and sisters getting to very old age. What are they having in common? What are they not? Our findings correlate with other studies of aging, showing that if you're just looking at average aging, people living, say, up into their early 90s, about 70-75% of that, the variation in how old people live to be is related to their health-related behaviors, mm-hmm. whether they're smoking or drinking or not exercising, being couch potatoes or doing all the right things. It's going to be the behaviors that are going to explain the vast majority of who's going to live to up to around age 90 or so and who is not. But then after about age 95 or so, we start to see a very interesting and growing importance of genes and the ability to get to these most extreme ages. By the time you're looking at people getting to about 100, I'd say maybe about 40% of that is going to be genetics, and the other 60% still, you know, your health behaviors are playing a really important role. By the time you're looking at our most rare individuals, 105, 110, there's a really strong genetic role going on there. Mm-hmm. The other important thing we found is it isn't so much lacking genes that seem to predispose to various diseases, or what we call disease risk genes that would increase your risk for heart disease or stroke or diabetes or various cancers. They have just as many or the same frequency of those genetic variants as the rest of the population. What they do have that's special is protective genes, genes that slow down aging and decrease your risk for age-related diseases. Unfortunately, it isn't just one gene. That would be easy to look at. It's more likely many, many genetic variants, each one having a modest effect on people's healthy aging. It's the combination of a bunch of these, I'd say probably 200 genetic variants or so, that are what it takes. It's like winning the lottery. It's not getting one or two or three. It's getting this the correct bunch. And those are very, very rare combinations when you're looking at people getting to 110. That's why they're so rare. But it is like winning the lottery in terms of the payoff when you have a signature like that.
So it sounds like getting to 90, we do have quite a bit of control over. That's our lifestyle decisions. Getting to 100, you really need to stack good lifestyle on top of good genetics. Is that a fair assessment?
That's the fair assessment. One of the big challenges, but also an opportunity for us, is that these genetic signatures vary a lot by ancestry, you know, race and ethnicity, where individuals of particular ancestries evolved under what conditions, with what kind of diets and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's an opportunity for us because we want to try and find what these groups are, how they're different, but also what they have in common. We really need to do that to solve this puzzle.
You mentioned the Alzheimer's organization assisting with the funding of the research. Can you just talk a little bit about cognitive decline? You cite in your research centenarians, they have a resistance, or is it more the body repairing? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think getting back to this idea that they are aging very slowly, there's this whole science behind what some of your listeners to the podcast know about, these things called biological clocks, where we use this molecular data information to try and gauge how old a person is chronologically, when were they born, versus how well are they aging from a molecular biology point of view. And where there's a gap, what we find with the centenarians, for example, is for those who are 100, maybe they have biologic clocks that make them look like they're 85 or 90. Hmm. So they are aging very slowly. And as a result, they're also, they have markedly decreased rates of aging related diseases. Or if they are going to develop any of these things, it's going to be in their mid to late 90s or even later, depending upon how old they live to be. And with the Alzheimer's disease, we are somewhat hell-bent on trying to understand what biological mechanisms confer this resilience. They may even have a predisposition for various reasons, environmental or genetic, for developing Alzheimer's disease, but there may be other things going on that combat that confer this resilience. I wish I could tell you what those mechanisms are. We have some ideas, but I think we will be making those discoveries soon. I would say within the next 5 years, given the work that we're doing, particularly at the Center for Regenerative Medicine, using these stem cell in a dish models to test how and why they're doing this.
Yeah, we want to talk a little bit about that too, and when we discuss the future of longevity. But no, that's great. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, lifestyle is such an important part of the aging process, and what we can do on a day-to-day basis makes such a big difference in terms of not only how long we live, but the quality of that.
And I would love to talk about those habits. I know in your research, you have like 7 factors that help with longevity. You came up with an acronym, SAGING. So I would love for you to just talk about that and provide the audience with some just habits that we can implement today to help with a healthier, longer life.
I would love to do that. And I do want to point out just how incredibly important health-related behaviors are. It was rather amazing to me, though, to realize that the average bunch of us should be able to live to about 90. There was a time when I thought it was more like 80. Average life expectancy now in this country is about 79 for men, 82 for women. Mm-hmm. In some other parts of the world, average life expectancy, like in Vancouver, British Columbia, for example, is quite a bit higher, more like around 85, 86. And as we talked about before, the vast majority of this is explained by health behaviors, but also environments that we may not have so much control over as well. So I think a real wake-up call and very important to realize is, for example, in Back Bay, here in Boston, average life expectancy is a whopping 93 years. And one would think, given that it's Back Bay, that that's high socioeconomic status, more years of education, a very well-informed population that also has resources to do things like exercise and have very healthy diets, many years of education, and so on. If you go 3 miles southeast of Back Bay, very close to here at Boston Medical Center, where I'm a professor of medicine and see patients as well, average life expectancy is 27 years less, just 3 miles away.
Wow.
And that's all going to be...
That is staggering.
You know, that's health disparities and a whole range of stresses, all speaking to the really significant importance of environment. Mm. So let's get to SAGING, which for the most part, I think, is all about the things that you can do that I would say if you do everything right and you have the right exposures that you may or may not have control over, you should be able to live to about 93. S is sleep, getting adequate sleep. We can get into the biology, what have you, but I think for the sake of time, let me just give you the prescription. And if people have more questions, we can get into that with another podcast. But I think most people know about the amount of sleep that they need to feel refreshed in the morning, and they even realize that when you don't get enough sleep, that can cause cognitive impairment. I know when I had 36-hour shifts, you did not want me as your doctor after 36 hours of being awake. So this affects everybody, but I would say even older people are more susceptible. So, you know, I would say 8 hours of sleep is important. Some people say 6 is enough for them. The next one is A, which is attitude. There's a whole body of science looking at how optimism and a positive outlook on aging is a very healthy thing. We have done personality testing on our centenarians as well as their offspring and found that they tend to score high in a couple of traits. One is extroversion and score low in neuroticism. And neuroticism, kind of like Woody Allen, I guess, they just adore to hold on to their stress. These individuals, our centenarians and their kids, they naturally know how to get rid of stress. And most of us know what habits make us feel better in terms of stress, whether that be exercise, meditation, religious practices, right? So do things that you know that help you manage your stress. It's not so much the amount of stress, it's how you manage it that's key. Mm-hmm. S-A-G is genetics. Yeah, we can't pick our parents or grandparents. But I think where this is important is you should look at your family history. What diseases are running in the family? What habits run in the family? what ages are people living to? If there are things like colon cancer or another cancer that runs in the family, then you need to be extra good about screening for those things, perhaps even at an earlier age, and avoid things known to be associated with cancer. Of course, smoking, which we'll get into, is a huge one that you don't need to know what's going on in your family to avoid. But I think looking at the family history of family members is a very, very powerful and important tool. SAGE is exercise. I would say 30 minutes of heart-raising exercise every day.
Okay,
I'll be nice and say 5 days a week. if you can, as you get older, mix that up with strength training exercise. That's very, very important to doing things to build muscle and keep muscle. And there are studies to show we have people in their 90s who've lost a lot of muscles, but you start getting them on a weight training program. It does things like support their joints and improve their osteoarthritis, but it also does things like reduce falls. And very importantly and interestingly, it also enhances memory. There's a really important muscle-brain axis. Again, something for us to talk about in the future. SAGEI is interest, and just like exercising muscles, you want to exercise your brain. Mm-hmm. Listen to this podcast on a regular basis. But I also,
thank you.
You know, I think the heavy lifters in terms of exercising your brain would be learning a new musical instrument or learning a new language, things that are particularly challenging and difficult. Interestingly, though, as you get into it and do more of it, it becomes easier, which may correlate with the new connections you're making between different parts of the brain. As you get into that particular thing that you're getting into. And then there are these puzzles and mind games and apps that people have heard about that may claim it does things like reduce your chances of getting Alzheimer's. I don't know how well that's proven, but the reason I promote this idea is because it certainly can't hurt.
Sure.
AGEIN is nutrition. There are certain diets well known to be healthier, certainly avoiding red meat, avoiding sweets. I think that generally a Mediterranean diet, which would be whole foods, but also fish, vegetables, nuts. I think, again, staying away from sweets is a good idea, mostly because of what I think is the most important thing about nutrition. Is trying to be on a diet that helps you maintain a healthy weight. And for some people, being a little heavy is still a healthy weight. They know, again, like relieving stress, they know what it takes to feel good. And maybe being a bit overweight, a person still feels strong and quick on their feet and agile. And even with our centenarians, a lot of our women centenarians tend to be a little on the stocky side, which may also be good in terms of reducing your risk for osteoporosis. I think the main thing, again, about nutrition is maintaining a diet that helps you stay at a healthy weight. AGEING. The last one is get rid of the smoking, absolutely no smoking, but also get rid of the anti-aging quackery. Do not fall for these anti-aging scams where they're saying we can stop or even reverse aging, just take our pill mm-hmm. or our injection, like growth hormone or testosterone. I would say that the best guide for telling you whether or not something works is whether if there's been good clinical research studies showing that it works. All these things that these guys are, these clinics and what have you that are claiming for the most part are absolutely false. And it's not only bad for you, it's bad for your wallet. Just don't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was a good segue into our next section. We wanted to talk about myths and misinformation. So, you know, everywhere we look on social media, there's another longevity expert, and you've been very outspoken about the dangers of anti-aging quackery. What is there anybody, so get into kind of some of the controversial treatments, whether it's rapamycin or metformin, but is there anyone that you would follow? So who do you look at in terms of a leader in this field other than yourself and your team of researchers?
I think most, good physicians are aware of the dangers of this practice of anti-aging quackery and these clinics. And, in addition to promoting these drugs or hormones, I think they also distract people from doing things that we know are healthy and good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And what are good habits? And hopefully one has a clinician and others that help, guide you in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think so much of it is common sense. One really doesn't need a guru.
Right.
I am outspoken about this because I have seen the dangers realized with these treatments. I'm very frustrated by even, wonderful 94-year-old neighbor who I love and adore, and he gets all this stuff in the mail and he's always asking about it. And sometimes he even, pays a lot of money for bottles of jellyfish stuff that's supposed to improve his brain. And
it's everywhere.
It probably doesn't help either that, we used to say about weight loss, well, there's no magic pill, but now there is a magic pill. So that probably doesn't help. I mean, the quick fixes, now we've got something that we can take and drop 30 pounds, just like that. So I'm sure that that's not helping the situation.
I'm all in favor of good science and clinical research studies that show that that there's benefit and that if there is risk that it's okay. But if the idea is that one is well informed by good science.
Mm-hmm.
And if something comes up like an injection you can take to help you lose 20 or 30 pounds, for individuals who've tried, they're darndest.
Yeah.
And
agreed.
And they're not having side effects that are bad for them or make it untenable to use the medication. I am all for that.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have issues is people hawking something that there's no proof of that could potentially actually be very bad for them, but at the least they're just making a lot of money out of people. It's just incredibly unethical and amoral.
And you can't scroll through social media these days without 11 ads jumping at you, and you're like, oh, well, let me check this out. So it's hard to avoid. It's really hard to avoid right now. I would love to talk about the future of longevity. If there is something that 5 years, 10 years down the road that you're thinking about that excites you, we'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Well, I think, Darren touched upon, I don't think they're necessarily part of the anti-aging quackery, but Darren did mention rapamycin and metformin. There's a few other drugs that people are looking at. None of the rapamycin or metformin experts are out there indicating to people to take these things. There are still some good clinical research studies that are being conducted to really determine whether or not these drugs are helpful for slowing down aging and decreasing your risk for age-related diseases. The two go together, and that's why there's this whole field of what's called geroscience, which is trying to understand the mechanisms of aging and even accelerated aging. If one can understand what those mechanisms are and develop treatments and strategies to interfere with those, then by slowing down aging, you're also decreasing the risk for age-related diseases. Mm-hmm. So they go hand in hand. And that's why these drugs like rapamycin and metformin are pretty interesting, because they kind of hit a whole bunch of different aging mechanisms at once. And the question then is, are taking those drugs helpful in decreasing your risk for things like cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, cancers, what we what are the kind of the aging related diseases. They're not ready for prime time yet. I think people are still investigating them. And the other thing I mentioned to you is those genetic signatures and the gene environment interactions that lead to people becoming 100 and even older, they vary from one group to another. So there's another thing that needs to happen in longevity studies and therapies is this thing called precision medicine, where one thing is not going to fit everybody. It's going to probably take some tweaking in terms of what combination of a drug and health habits or screening or what have you is going to work for a particular person.
That makes sense.
So yeah. I think beyond the two important ones that you brought up, rapamycin and metformin, there are a couple of other drugs that are already out there that people are just taking off the shelf to study. There are other drugs that are being investigated. Studies like mine, you know, I think we're probably within 5 years of making some breakthrough discoveries and looking at some specific biological mechanisms. And then the trick is to their targets to then develop drugs, biomarkers that one can screen and watch in people to see if they're at risk for various age-related diseases or at risk for something wonderful, like living to 100. All of that, I think, is coming down the pike, which is really optimistic of me. I can't say that I felt that way 10 years ago. But the way things are going now and with how inexpensive studying these things have become, when it was $1 gazillion before, it's much more affordable now.
That's exciting. Yeah. So you during your study, you mentioned or you during one of your presentations, I saw it, Sarah Knaus, I believe. And she lived to 119 years old. And from what your research told us, healthy. She was, I think, a great, great, great grandmother. And my question to you is, if somebody today is living to 119 years old, is there someone that has been born today, someone alive today, that knowing what you know is going to live to 150 years old or some just outrageous number within the next, say, you know, 50, 60 years?
Well, let me put that question into the context of the person, the oldest ever person, who was 122. Mm-hmm. That was Jean Calment, a lady in the south of France, who died in 1997 at 122.
Yeah.
I guess that's almost 30 years later, and billions of people. Nobody's come close to 122. Okay. And Sarah Knaus, there's one person, she got knocked down a run from being the second oldest to the third oldest. You think 119 is close. It's really not that close. It's 3 years, which is an enormous period of time at that extreme.
And she looked great from the picture that I saw too. I mean, she, you know, 119 years old, that's pretty amazing.
And she was, you know, at 119, which is when she passed away, she was frail. She was still had great long-term memory, very interestingly, at 116. Mm. She was crazy amazing in terms of her cognitive function. Could have danced circles around me. and that's the key is, you know, how well she was aging. But to answer your question, I think one really hits the wall by around 122 or so in terms of what our bodies and our blueprint are capable of doing. And these individuals are one per billions. I think it's very, very unlikely. I think there was even recently people were talking about Putin and the president of China and others doing things that they were proposing. You know, if they get enough organ transplants, they're going to live to forever. I challenge them to think of a way to do a brain transplant. You know, it's that kind of,
I don't know if I'd challenge
thinking
him to that.
That's a little bit silly. While it would be wonderful to be thinking about, it's really this has been the stuff of science fiction for millennia, right? People think that they could figure out a fountain of youth and live forever. Honestly, if everybody could just do the saging and get most people living to age 93 and compress the time that they're experiencing disability towards the very end of their lives, if they develop diseases, they're still dealing with them much, much better than otherwise. That would be the boon to society. And I think that's what we really need to be concentrating on.
Yeah. No, I mean, like you said, it really is, in the end, most of it is common sense, right? I mean, just take care of yourself, get good sleep, live moderately.
Willpower and seeing the payoff.
Yeah, willpower.
And too. Yeah.
So as we wrap, I think I know the answer to this, because when we first, when we tried to get you on the show, it, you know, not an easy guy to book, but we finally heard from you, and you had just wrapped up you're in the process of wrapping up your hiking trip to the Dolomites. So how has your research impacted the way that you live your life day to day?
The idea of living at least 33 years beyond the age of 60. And doing that at a time that at some point I retire and I can really do some of the fun things that I'd love to do, like hiking and being outdoors and enjoying time with my family. The idea that those 33 years don't have to be filled with disability and a lot of the things that I see as a geriatrician, that I have power over that for the most part, is incredibly enabling. And I think the existence of these centenarians, they raise the bar for the rest of us in terms of thinking about what is achievable, so that if a lot of people are getting to 100, are able to live, who are able to basically run a marathon, I think it makes a lot of easier for a bunch of us to think about running a 10K race, getting a 93.
I've got a neighbor who's 78 and he's running in his 44th Chicago Marathon. I think it's this upcoming week.
Wow.
And he has inspired me. I'm like, if he can do that, I think I can get my butt out of the house and run 3 or 4 miles. So it really does impact people when you say that. So
before we wrap up, I do want to ask you just our health and wellness question. And I know we have saging. You've been very gracious on sharing kind of health and wellness tips, but can you be a little bit more specific? What's one daily habit that you would like to share with the audience that will really prolong longevity? And it's just something that you do on a daily basis that you really couldn't live without.
I wish I could do this better, but I think being mindful, just in terms of being aware of the moment, being aware of things that you're doing that are good or bad for you, being aware of what brings you joy and what is fulfilling to you, and to act on that and to be proactive. We go through our days not doing that. And then those are lost moments. I think really taking advantage of those moments and seizing the day and being proactive is really, really important.
I love that. It's a great reminder.
Yeah. No, it's something I try to practice every day, and it is a challenge because, you know, life moves so quickly. So that's great. Okay. Well, let's wrap. So just thinking about just recapping, I think, you know, some of the important highlights, and again, this is something that we could continue to have, you know, several more episodes on, but really, you know, getting to 90, we do have so much control of that, right? In our daily lifestyle, you know, our sleep, our nutrition, our exercise, being mindful, being social, that really can lead us to living a longer, healthier life. Getting to 100, well, that's a little bit more of a roll of the dice, as you say, with the genes. It's interesting to me that 75% of our longevity is driven by our lifestyle. So like you say, it's empowering. It really is up to us in terms of the quality of life that we want to live. There is no silver bullet yet, I'll say in parentheses, right? Holding out hope. And then just in terms of what we do, you know, quality sleep, I think intentional social interaction seem like that is so critically important. You mentioned trying a new skill. Maybe you can see over my back right shoulder, the guitar there. I picked that up in November. It is incredibly difficult, extremely rewarding at times. And that's something I've always thought about doing, and it has been so good for me. So that's, you know, I think that's a credit to trying to do something different. So thank you, Dr. Pearl, so much for your insight. This has been fantastic. We'd love to have you on again. Your practical advice has been incredibly valuable. Your work is helping so many people, so keep at it. And the study is still going on, correct?
Oh, very much.
Great. So we appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you so much for inspiring our audience and giving us some actionable steps. For anyone who wants to dive deeper, we highly recommend checking out Dr. Pearl's book, Living to 100. And you can also visit the NECS, the New England Centenarian Study website. Check out the latest research, life expectancy calculator. I completed the calculator. I've got 93, knock on wood. So we'll see, you know. I feel like I just jinxed myself. And be sure to subscribe to the newsletter as well. The newsletter, I believe, just is letting people know of all the most updated research and about valuable information there. So that would be helpful. And to our listeners, if you found this episode helpful, please subscribe, share it with somebody you care about. And until next time, stay curious, take care of your physical, mental, and financial health. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of More Than Wealth. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the More Than Wealth podcast. Click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Visit our website at advisors.ubs.com/thegoldgroup or give us a call at 617-261-2662. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Gold Wealth Management Group. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning.
Please do not transmit orders or instructions regarding a UBS account by email. For your protection, UBS does not accept and act on such instructions. Similarly, UBS does not accept trading instructions via voicemail, text messages, instant messaging, or facsimile. Do not include information containing account numbers, social security numbers, credit card numbers, passwords, or other personal information. Please speak directly with your financial advisor if you need to give instructions related to your account. Please be advised that where data regarding your account and/or accounts is provided in this email, it should not be considered official UBS books and records. Official UBS records. Official UBS records are documents such as confirmation, statements, and portfolio management reports, which UBS provides to you periodically. In some cases, the data shown is taken from internal UBS systems and fluctuates with market and transaction activity. Assets in your account and/or accounts that are not valued daily, for example, alternative investments and annuities, are accurately reflected only in official UBS records. You should review your official UBS records for disclosures about those values and all of the information needed to understand the data provided with this email. For non-clients, if you do not want to receive these types of commercial email messages, please complete the unsubscribe form at https://www.ubs.com/us/en/wealth-management/contact-us/unsubscribe.html. to indicate that you do not want to be contacted by email. For more information about how UBS processes your data, including how we protect your rights and respect your data, please refer to our privacy notice at https https://www.ubs.com/global/en/legal/privacy/USA.html.